My name's Norman Baker. I was for 18 years a Member of Parliament for the Lib Dems, representing Lewes and East Sussex. And for about 5 years, I was a government minister. First of all, at the Department for Transport, dealing with public transport, and then at the Home Office as a Crime Prevention Minister. Subsequently, I've released 3 books, with the fourth one coming out in September. I also host 2 radio shows a week on my local FM station,
which is
Sea Haven FM, where our one show is about blues music and one is about called Hidden 60s, about material from the 1960s people haven't heard.
Now, your job in the Home Office sounds particularly like quite an interesting one, Norman. Could you give us an idea whereabouts between Dominic Cummings' recent portrayal of the idea that ministers these days just get told what to say and think, and yes, minister, what was it really like?
Well, I was never happy to be told what to say and think, and that's one of the reasons why it was very difficult working with Theresa May, because she had a determination.
She was the Home Secretary,
She was a Home Secretary, a determination to try and run the department on a kind of very narrow base, where she and her 2 special advisors decided everything, even the language to be used, and I wasn't having that. First of all, it was a coalition, and secondly, I said, well, even if we're following government policy, which I accept, I have to follow government policy, I'm not expressing it with the language you want me to use. So it was continual battle until I got fed up with it and walked out, and notably said at the time that it was like walking through mud dealing with her.
Can you give us an idea of any particular issue where there was a bit of a tug of war over where it should be presented and how you managed to win the day, or maybe you were crushed by May and her friends?
I wasn't crushed, certainly. No, I mean, it was almost everything. I mean, the coalition worked quite well across departments. And the Department for Transport, for example, was very friendly and a degree of consideration and commonality in what we were doing. The Home Office was the sharp end of the coalition, where we had totally different views on what should be done in a whole range of issues. And one of them, for example, was drug policy, where I conducted a survey, an international comparator study of policy in other countries, which demonstrated very clearly that treating drugs as a health issue was not just more humane, but actually reduced drug use, whereas Theresa May wanted to treat it as a criminal issue and lock people up, which actually wasn't going to solve the problem. So that was one example of where there was a conflict. But, you know, in the end, I mean, she wanted to, well, not in the end, all the way through, she wanted to control what I was saying and control the language and quotes directly in press releases. I'm not having that. I'm making my own quotes up. And on one day, they changed a quote and put her a quote in my name.
Oh.
So I said that, right, well, next time I've got a quote to go out, I shall ring the press personally. I'll contact PA, and I'll tell you afterwards what I've said. And I did that. So they had to concede in the end that I was able to say what I wanted to say. So I won that one.
Well, it's a lot of sounds like, you know, you've got to put in almost like constant pushback in that sort of situation. But on drugs, I can remember watching years ago the film Key Largo. I think it was Humphrey Bogart.
And yes,
he talked
it was.
About the organised criminals actually loving prohibition of drugs. Well, actually, I think at the time it was alcohol. But the implication is that there is a massive criminal market that's actually created when something is criminalised, but the enforcement is either impossible or the gangsters are paying the police off.
Well, I mean, you look back at, well, that's certainly true. Look at prohibition in the 1930s in America. It was a total failure. And what it did was empower the gangsters. And also it was unsafe for people because you had to buy alcohol without any controls on what was in it. There's a whole lot of dodgy alcohol substances which caused deaths in many cases. And if you actually have a state controlling the supply of drugs, whether it's tobacco or alcohol or anything else, then there's a certain standards which people can expect to be adhered to in terms of what they're actually buying and what they're using. So I mean, no doubt that you know, the so-called war on drugs that came in 1971 has been a complete failure.
Here in Bristol, drugs like cannabis, ecstasy, ketamine seem to be, you know, unofficially acceptable by the police. In fact, cannabis is smoked openly around the city, and yet it's, I mean, doesn't this really undermine the whole idea of having a law?
Well, I mean, you're looking at a wider issue with the police. The police seem to me to be have decided to decriminalise a whole range of offences, including, I'm afraid, shoplifting and burglary. I mean, no one's ever caught for these things anymore. They seem to turn most of the time in large numbers policing person pr policing quite lawful and legal protests, which they shouldn't be doing. So there's a whole issue about how the police behave generally, but. There are drugs which are, I think, harmful. I wouldn't recommend taking any drugs particularly, but I mean there are drugs which are more harmful than others, like crack cocaine. Cannabis is, in its pure form, is not harmful in the same way as alcohol is, or tobacco. And one of my concerns has been the transformation from natural cannabis, which was what was around when I was a young person. To this chemical kind of skunk type stuff, which I think is far more dangerous. And if normal cannabis, traditional cannabis, were legalized or decriminalized and controlled by the state, then in my view, that would help to improve health outcomes by moving people away from dangerous skunk onto much less harmful natural cannabis.
Now, I'm not sure what the King makes of all of this, whether he's interested in drugs policy, but you have written a book about the royal family, haven't you? I think it's called "And What Do You Do?"
I've written two. That one was called, and forgive my impersonation of the Queen. And what do you do? Because that's what they always ask you when you arrive at the palace. That's the first question. And if you don't get a satisfactory answer, the second question is, have you come far? They're the two opening gambits of all family users. Well, I thought I spent time when you knew what they did, which is why I call the book, And What Do You Do? Because there's a whole lot of stuff the royal family does that we don't know about. And actually, the more you dig into it, the less attractive it is. And what you have to understand is they are driven by a greed to accumulate more and more money, ideally from the public purse, but frankly from anybody. And that's a corrupting factor, a cancer almost within the royal family. Perhaps I shouldn't use the word cancer given what's happened to Kate and Charles, but it's a malignant influence in the royal family, that desire for money.
Well,
So
look,
my
Norman,
next book
this
coming
also
out, hang on a
reflects.
second, my next book coming out in September
Oh.
Is called Royal Mint National Debt, which looks at the finances of the royal family in a lot more detail.
Well, look, I mean, this, if you want to think about things like the trickle-down effect, I mean, this is not just the royal family that this is affecting, this massive imbalance of wealth, funneling wealth, the powerful funneling wealth to themselves and leaving the majority, the masses, impoverished by it. So do you think that there's any correlation between the two?
Well, I mean, that's a much wider question, Tony, as to government policy. I mean, I noticed that, for example, the government's been saving money on the corners when it comes to disability benefits, but seems to be making far less effort to deal with tax evasion, which, of course, is a far more lucrative pocket to try and dig into, which they seem reluctant to do so. I mean, I think you do lead from the top, and if the royal family shows a tendency to be greedy and accumulate money from the public purse, then I suppose that does set a standard for others to follow, unfortunately.
But one of the ways they spend this money, I know, is on making sure that there's a nice, good, squeaky clean public image. Have you any idea of the extent, of the royal public relations machine?
Well, indeed, in my last book on What Do You Do, there's a whole chapter on that. Which goes into some detail as to how they manipulate, manufacture, and control the image which is presented to the public. They do so by making sure that they provide nice photos that they want to see in the press of their children, at the same time as arguing that the children should be exempt from scrutiny from the public press. That double standard they take forward. They do it by legal action, by clamping down on people who dare to challenge them. We've seen with Prince Harry in the tabloids, for example. They do it by control behind the scenes through influencing government ministers and so on in a way that they don't want people to find out about. They control it by making sure that any journalists who dare to challenge them are kind of kept out of the loop and not given the stories that other pro-royal journalists are given. So, I mean, that's just some examples. There's a whole range of things they do to control their image. It goes back to Victorian times when they started issuing postcards of Queen Victoria and Prince Albert. I mean, and making money that way. There's been a royal minute image machine going on for almost 200 years.
Well, one of the frightening things about this is it was revealed a couple of years ago that actually Jimmy Savile had penned the Royal Public Relations Policy,
Yes.
But look, the bottom line is how much a year gets spent on public relations for the royal family? Because you've just described an enormous machine, and obviously this is going to cost money.
Well, I mean, I don't know how much I spent on that particularly, on that one aspect, but it's not all money. It's also about influence. It's about leaning on people. That doesn't necessarily cost any money. I mean, Buckingham Palace has got a media outfit, which is designed to issue information of help to the royal family. When I contact them and ask them awkward questions, they don't bother giving me the information back. So they are very selective in what they give out. And of course, the royal family has more and more exempted itself from the Freedom of Information Act, in the sense that you can now get almost nothing out about them from that act, which is going in the opposite direction to anybody else. Network Rail, for example, has been brought into the Freedom of Information Act, and it's been widened. The royal family's been increasingly exempt from it, largely as a consequence of pressure from Charles, who objected violently to the Guardian successful case to get his spider letters, the so-called spider letters, released when he was influencing government ministers or trying to influence government ministers quite improperly. I mean, it wasn't his business to try and influence government policy. That's what the royals are supposed to do. So Charles, rather than when it was exposed that he was doing this, rather than saying I shouldn't be doing it, his answer was to try and exempt himself from freedom of information to make sure that he'd carry on doing it, but nobody would know about it in the future.
Yes, there was also some publication, I think it was the Daily Mail, of some of his letters that he sends out to a wide public bunch of friends of his. And the idea was that we need to know about this sort of thing. And obviously, if you've got a letter from the King, who is now the King, he was Prince Charles at the time, which says something extremely controversial, say about politics, which Charles does seem to be much more interested in making political statements than his mother was, that is in the public interest. The public should know.
Well, of course. I mean, they are part of the public sector, just in the same way as ministers are, as MPs are, as members of the House of Lords are, as councillors are, as people who work for the NHS, people who work in schools. They are part of the public service sector because they're paid out of public money, and they should be accountable for that public money. And they are not in the same way, and they should be.
Yeah, well, it's things like I can remember the repairs to Buckingham Palace went into many, many millions. This is all paid by us. But look, I'm going to try and hold your feet to the fire a bit, Norman, about money, because this PR operation, as journalists and anyone working in communications nowadays, so much of communication seems to have been taken over by lobbies and lobbyists, and there's so little real investigative journalism around in the public interest these days. I try and take a ballpark stab figure at how much is spent on PR every year by the royals.
I can't do that. I mean, there's a cost that can be established, I suppose, for the Buckingham Palace PR machine. There's a cost, I suppose, can be identified with what William and Kate have in their office. These are individual people with salaries, and I suppose they've got offices to which they fill.
Well, it would be nice to do a freedom of information request, wouldn't it?
Or you wouldn't get the answer. You can ask Buckingham Palace, but they are exempt from freedom of information, so the royal household is not subject to FOI. The answer, Tony, is probably not as much as you think. I mean, the influence comes through pressure, not from spending money, I think, on this occasion.
Well, it still takes a rather large staff to do it. Anyway, we've seen recently the articles in the Daily Mail, one particularly, which funnily enough is very difficult to find on. I just put the name James Stunt and cocaine and the Royals into various different search engines. It seems to have almost disappeared. It's only out a couple of weeks ago without a trace. But this guy James Stunt is a money launderer. At least he was accused of that. He's managed to get off from that. £200 million apparently he'd laundered. But the Mail has pointed out that actually he's also seems to be involved. Well, he is involved in cocaine too. But he's also very, very pally with the King.
Yes. Well, there's a couple of things about this, I think. The first thing is to say that, contrary to public opinion and public expectation, the newspaper, which has done most in the last 20 years to expose embarrassing matters about the royals, has been the Daily Mail or the Mail on Sunday. So, and the Guardian's done a good job in many ways as well, but it's been the Mail who's dug out stuff like this all the way through. So, although the Mail's not my natural cup of tea as a liberal, I pay tribute to the fact that they still do believe in investigative journalism at the Mail, which a lot of papers have given up on. The second thing to say is that Charles has got a very bad sense of judgment when it comes to individuals. In fact, he's prepared to set aside any judgments he has if they give him money for his good causes. The saving grace for Charles is he wants money for his good causes, whereas Andrew wanted money for himself. So I suppose that's a feather in Charles's cap to a degree. But the fact is that he's been associating with a whole range of dodgy people over the years simply because they give him money. They're all laid out in my books, And What Do You Do? And even more information, I might say, in my new book, which is coming out in September, Royal Mint National Debt. And it doesn't read well for Charles. But let's just give you one example, two examples. He was, as you mentioned earlier on, great friends with Jimmy Savile. Jimmy Savile, actually incredible, Jimmy Savile, a bachelor, advised him and Diana on their marriage. Well, Jim didn't fix that, did he? Why he thought that was going to be successful, I've no idea. He was also, Charles went to see him in his cottage. He gave him presents. And when he died, Charles and Camilla were the first out of the trap to say how sorry they were and how much he'd been a wonderful figure in this country. That's all disappeared from the Royal Archives, but it's there in history that that's what they did. So terrible judgment as far as Jimmy Savile was concerned. He was warned, by the way, Charles, by a whole range of people that he should keep away from Savile, and he put that down to jealousy and didn't see it. And the other thing, Charles won't listen to good advice when it's given to him. The second example I can give you is the Bishop of Lewes, Peter Ball, the former Bishop of Lewes, who became friends with Charles. He was then convicted, or accepted a caution, same thing, for abusing a 17-year-old boy by whipping him in order to allegedly, extract his evil from him in terms of his Christianity or some other nonsense like that. And Charles, although he knew about this offence, and knew about the caution, was very friendly with the bishop and very rude and unhelpful and incompassionate about the 17-year-old, who, by the way, then committed suicide. So Charles has got really bad judgment when it comes to individuals, and that's just two examples. There's a litany of them set out in my two books.
Well, this guy James Stunt, in the recent Mail article, the headlines: "Cocaine Playboy's Extraordinary Friendship with the King, a posh
Yes.
banquet, a private meeting at Clarence House, and a luxury watch from Harrods as a gift to Charles, and the butler who saw it all reveals all." I mean, these royal stories most definitely do sell papers, which is one of the reasons, obviously, that you would expect there'd be more of this kind of thing. Apparently, he was able to forge a close association with the King. And predictably, however, the article says it was a relationship that ended in embarrassment when Charles, whom Stunt had loaned a series of supposed masterpieces, was embroiled in a fake art scandal
Yeah.
first exposed by the Daily Mail. Now, this guy is involved, it seems, maybe he's just got off from this in money laundering, cocaine, fake art scandals. The guy's obviously a criminal, but he did donate 140,000 to the Prince's charities.
Well, I mean, the question for Charles really is, first of all, did he know about this? And did he then turn a blind eye to it because money was coming in? Or did he not know? In which case, the question is, why didn't he know? Because he was to be advised on these matters. And I think that when the King or the Prince of Wales meets somebody in that sort of environment, that kind of very cosy environment, there ought to have been a check done. And I'm sure there was a check done. And Charles, I suspect, said, "I'm not paying attention to that because the man's giving me money." That's what I think would have happened in this particular case. But he really needs to be avoid looking like a mafia boss, doesn't he, dealing with these sorts of people? But time and again, he does it.
Yeah, mafia. It does. You're right. Yeah, the black spider letters, the spider in the middle. But also, there's something more sinister to this, because we've heard today about the Home Office considering the proscribing Palestine Action, which is the non-violent direct action group. I mean, they have attacked and smashed up some of the windows of Barclays Bank here in Bristol, I know, but they've also been spraying paint onto military aircraft. Murdoch's Empire has been calling for them to be shot, and now we're hearing that the Home Office is considering making them turning them into a terrorist organisation, Norman.
Well, I don't agree with that course of action at all. And I have to say that my experience of politics over many, many years has been that the Labour Party cannot be trusted with civil liberties in this country. I saw that when they were in government, when they were having, they wanted 90 days without detention, without trial. They wanted ID cards. They're very cavalier when it comes to individual liberties, the Labour Party. And that's one of the things that actually, curious enough, when the coalition came along, the Tories and Lib Dems were in a closer position than we were with Labour. But this reaction of calling these people terrorists, I think, well, we'll see what the Home Secretary says in terms of evidence. But, you know, my view is that if you undertake action like spraying planes or breaking windows, that is criminal damage. It's an offence. The people who do it should be charged, and they should be charged with criminal damage. But it's not terrorism. Terrorism is threatening the lives of individual citizens, and they're not doing that, as far as I can tell. You know, I have to ask a question. If the pro-Israeli lobby in this country was going around spraying planes, would they be classed as a terrorist organisation? You have to ask yourself. The same day as the Home Secretary is apparently planning to make this lot a terrorist organisation, no doubt tens of people are being killed by Israeli soldiers in Gaza to try and access food. You know, which ones are the terrorists? Are those two groups?
Yeah, and the Israelis are actually, where they are, they're sitting in tanks, using tank machine guns, which seems a little bit over the top for starving people trying to get something to eat.
I think they're using target practice. I think they don't care. They're using as target practice.
Well,
I mean, it's really shocking what the Israelis are doing in Gaza. And I think there's been a failure of all political parties in this country to stand up to what is appalling illegal activity, war crimes, and probably genocide.
The SNP have, though, haven't they?
Well, they have a bit, and so the Lib Dems a bit, but it's not gone far enough.
Look, there's another side to the royal story, and that is the the very draconian actions, and it relates in a way to the Palestine Action one, Norman. About the, for example, at the coronation, we've also seen other events in London where the king is appearing. There are peaceful protesters turn up with placards, and as soon as they turn up, as soon as they get out of their minibus or whatever, they are arrested. And jailed. I mean, before they're even allowed to stand there and shout with a megaphone that we want to end the monarchy, or just wave a placard. Now, there are literally tens of people now who've been arrested in this way for actually committing no crime at all.
Yes, I have been, although I think the police have backed off a bit from that because, for example, I don't think there were, I stand to be corrected, I don't think there were arrests at the Troop in the Colour demonstration the other day. And I think the embarrassment that's come to the police from some of the arrests they've made have caused them to back off a bit. I mean, you ended up with situations where, I think it was in Edinburgh, people were told if they write "Not My King" on a piece of paper and hold it up, they were going to get arrested. And they were holding up blank pieces of paper, which is what happens in Xi Jinping's China, which is not a great sight, is it, for this country, the home of democracy. So I think we do have to look at the fact that there's been double standards applied. And people have got perfect right to protest. There was somebody in Oxford a couple of years ago who was when a proclamation came that Charles is now king, proclamation in Oxford, and he shouted out, "Who elected him?" He was immediately pulled away by police and charged. And actually, the monarchists who were there in the public watching and obviously supporting the proclamation, saying to the police, "Well, hang on a minute, this guy's entitled to his view. Why are you arresting him?" So not even monarchists were supporting the way he was being treated. And of course, he subsequently got compensation for the police for wrongful arrest. But, you know, that's a situation we have in this country, that the police are showing a double standard. Depending what you're protesting against, they react in a different way. And that's completely wrong. They should simply be enforcing the law. And it's not illegal, as you said, to stand up there and protest against something you don't like in this country.
Yeah, especially when you're not actually even doing anything. You're just standing there with a placard. You're not encouraging any criminal activity. You're just urging for political change. But I wonder also if there has been some change in the country since the death of Queen Elizabeth, because King Charles does seem to be much more free with his political views. And also, of course, people then start to wonder just how much power does the royal family really have? Because there's quite a lot of patronage, of course, of all sorts of trusts and charities around the place. But more importantly, when you get police, army, civil servants, judges, they are all royal appointees. So, I mean, if you've got a weak government and a weak prime minister, surely the royal family actually can start, using a bit of muscle to appoint the people it wants to these very important jobs.
They don't appoint them, Tony. I mean, they are prime. They may be on paper appointed by the royals, but some of them. But they are effectively prime ministerial recommendations in nearly all cases. So I would exempt the royals from that particular
Well,
criticism.
yes, but
Having
one of the things I've heard, Norman, is that the royal family will suggest to ministers possibly through these black spider letters that we're not allowed to know about. We would prefer to see X, Y, and Z appointed.
Well, they might do that. I don't know, but ultimately, it's a matter for the Prime Minister of the day and the Cabinet to decide whether they pay any attention to that or not. I would be surprised if that was a very, very extensive. I mean, look, the royals do influence things behind the scenes quite significantly, including through the disgraceful concept of King's consent, whereby, and Prince of Wales' consent, whereby those two people are allowed to see draft legislation before Parliament does. And when it affects their personal and private interests, and make changes or lobby for changes to the draft law, as it would affect them personally before MPs even know about it. Now that's a disgrace. That happens. It's happened thousands of times since 1952. And when you say Charles is political, of course Charles has got political views. As it happens, I happen to agree with some of his political views, which is not the point. However, they need to be completely non-political. To be fair to him, I think he has toned down his public views, his public expression since he became king. Although quite clearly his desire to tackle climate change, for example, is still very, very evident.
Yeah, I mean, he was one of the leaks that came out is when he was Prince Charles, was that Putin is the new Hitler. He said that at a tennis match, apparently. He was overheard by a journalist. I mean, this could really damage relations, international relations, with views
Yes.
like this.
Well, absolutely. And I'm sure that if his views on Trump were known publicly, they'd be not dissimilar. And of course, he also, when he was at the handover of Hong Kong in 1997, went to represent Britain over that particular episode when the Union Jack was lowered for the last time. He called the Chinese people who were there, the Chinese government officials, appalling old waxworks was the phrase he used. Which is probably not very far from the truth, but you can't say that if you're in that position.
Oh, well, he seems to find it very difficult to hold his tongue. Overall, though, do you think there's been really any change since the death of the Queen?
I think there's been some change. I think, first of all, there was a willingness, I think, for the public at large to not rock the boat when the Queen was there, because she'd been there for a long time. She was thought by the public at large to have done, by and large, a good job. She hadn't put a foot wrong in terms of interfering in politics, or not visibly anyway. And it wasn't going to be very popular to attack her personally. So I think a lot of people were waiting for her to get out of the way, as it were, without putting it too crudely. And then Charles came along, and Charles let it be known in advance he wanted a slimmed down monarchy. Well, his idea of a slimmed down monarchy is one where there are fewer people on the balcony at Buckingham Palace, but the bill to the public goes up. We want a slimmed down bill, in my view, not a slimmed down monarchy necessarily. We want to spend less money on them. And he's not delivered that, he's delivering the opposite. And him and William are redoubling their efforts to get money out of the public purse in a quite disgraceful and unattractive way. So I think they're building up trouble for themselves, because the public at large, as and when they find out what's going on, don't like it. They don't like the excesses. If you ask me where I think the public is, the public's probably in favour of a monarchy, but a much more cheaper, slimmed down monarchy, in line with other European monarchies like the Dutch or the Belgians or the Scandinavian countries, which costs far less than our monarchy does. Ours is the last imperial monarchy in Europe, and I think they're in danger, the royal family, of bringing themselves down by their failure to modernise and their excessive greed for public money.
So what are William and Charles up to try and get more money out of us then?
Well, if you look at who they've got on there, how they're handling the Duchy of Lancaster and Duchy of Cornwall, you'll see that they're redoubling efforts to make money out of that. And I go into my new book some extraordinary examples of how they're just screwing money out of people in a most deliberate and unattractive way.
Well, is this through things like, acting as land developers, speculators, that sort of
Well,
thing?
the Duchy of Cornwall's council, for example, has been filled with investment bankers, so that tells you something.
Ah, right. Yes. This sort of, oh dear, inveigling their way in. But what about some other institutions associated with the monarchy, like the Privy Council? We hear virtually nothing about them, or the City of London.
Well, Privy Council is a curiosity. I'm a member of the Privy Council in theory. The Privy Council meets, I don't know, once every month, and there are four cabinet ministers there, plus the monarch, a couple of officials, and that's probably it.
But
They
they're
all
very
stand.
important. Look, I'll just say one thing, Norman, about here in Bristol, we've got this big organisation called the Merchant Venturers, which was set up by the people that financed John Cabot's trip to North America, which was effectively a kind of reconnaissance for genocide, and began the colonisation in the late 1400s. And then they set up an organisation to exploit the North America, which was formulated and constituted under a royal charter in the 1500s, but they're still here today, and none of us journalists can find out hardly anything about them. We keep being told, well, actually, only the Privy Council can scrutinise the merchant venturers because of the Royal Charter.
Well, that's probably true, and the same applies to certain universities and so on. I mean, you can write to the Privy Council office and ask for information out of that. They did open up a bit in about 2001 after I made a fuss about it, so they're slightly more open than they used to be. But essentially, the Privy Council is an opportunity for government rather than the royals, an opportunity for government to push things through without the public knowing. And the government, successive governments, have found it rather convenient to have that there in that place.
So, who are members of the Privy Council? You're obviously an ex-minister. Are all ex-ministers members?
No, they're not all. Basically, if you're a right honourable, then you're a member of the Privy Council. If you're just honourable, you're not.
And what about the role of the Bank of England? Because a lot of people are pointing the finger at them since Gordon Brown supposedly made interest rate setting independent, gave that to them, and saying, well, actually, the Bank of England, even though it's potentially the saviour of the nation, through printing money and giving it to poorer people to get the economy going, helping small businesses, that sort of thing, it's actually being captured by big commercial banks.
Well, I'm not an expert in the Bank of England, Tony. And I do think that Bank of England independence, which Gordon Brown brought in, was a sensible move because it meant that the bank wasn't subject to vagaries of politicians changing their mind every couple of weeks, which wasn't very good for stability. So I think the independence, to a degree, was sensible, but it had to be combined, of course, with the ability of politicians to determine public policy, for example, on taxation and so on.
Okay, and what about your experience, the role of the City of London? Because it's like a country within a country, isn't it?
Well, it is, and it's a major power in the country. It's a major opportunity to bring in money, some of it very dodgy, from countries around the world. It's got its own economy. It's got a lot of money laundering, which is why the City of London Police is the chief enforcement agency for tackling money laundering in this country, because that's where it goes through.
Well, they don't seem to be doing a very good job.
Well, they do some of it, but not enough of it, I think. But I'm not an expert on it, the City of London. But the fact is that it's a key part of this country, and it would take a lot to unwind it. And we have to be very careful if we unwind it to make sure we keep the good bits while getting rid of the bad
Well, yeah,
bits.
that might not be an easy job. Anyway,
It
look,
wouldn't be an
Norman, can
easy
you just
job.
run through your books where you're available and how people can find and follow you online?
Well, the books, there's four books out I've got out. The first one was The Strange Death of David Kelly, about the UN weapons inspector who disappeared under mysterious circumstances in 2003 and was, we were told, committed suicide, which, to my satisfaction, at least I've disproved. That was written in 2007. I've just updated it, actually. That came out last year in an updated form. Then I have my political memoirs called Against the Grain, came out in 2015, about my time in politics. Then there was And What Do You Do?, my book on the royals, which came out 2019, updated in 2021. And the next one coming out is on the Royal Finances, which comes out in September, which is Royal Mint National Debt. All of them available from Bite Back as a publisher. All of them available in good bookshops and no doubt bad bookshops as well. And all of them available through American multinationals like Amazon.
Oh, God. Well, look, finally, in a nutshell, what's the deal with David Kelly? How do we know he didn't commit suicide?
We have to buy the book and find out. But it's none of the, there's plenty of evidence to prove he didn't, and it's all in the book.
So, okay, but so who did kill him?
Well, that's in the book as well, insofar as I'm able to determine it. So,
okay, Norman, you're selling it very well there. Norman Baker, former Home Office Minister, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.